Coming up on this episode of the Creepercast, we take a trip to Japan to discuss J-horror. What is it? What are the origins? And why don't they do well in the West? We'll be comparing two sets of films with their U.S. titles, The Grudge and The Missed Call, with their Eastern counterparts. Also, Supernatural returns, Fringe ends, and Zombieland may be coming. Mike talks about a town with a little Cthulhu problem, and Jeff's news. So bind up that corpse and smash that cell phone, because you're listening to Creepercast, episode 108.
Hey, it's Gary Steiner from Night of the Living Dead and Save the Chapel, and I just wanted to say tune in to Creepercast. This has been 2.5 hours I just spent with, two really fun guys.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Creepercast, the world leader in horror news and opinions by two drunks and a hobo. I'm Jason, and you know Jeff and Mike. They like to play the childhood game Bloody Mary, which involves a real person named Mary, yet oddly, no mirror.
Yeah.
Which one of us is the hobo?
See, we're going to go back to introductions here. We're going to totally skip over whatever you just said and go straight to the introduction and say, which one of us is the hobo? We don't care about Bloody Mary. We care about who's a hobo.
I worked really hard on that.
If he would just keep her chained up, like I told him, we wouldn't have this whole Bloody Mary thing going on.
and the mirrors are so we don't have to see ourselves.
Okay. So that's why. It makes sense. Yeah. All right, want to let you know to get a hold of us, give us a call, 503-454-6941. Leave us email on our feedback email address at feedback@creepercast.com. Wow, did I really butcher that? We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/creepercast and on Twitter, twitter.com/creepercast. And now you can also leave us messages on our webpage at creepercast.com using our SpeakPipe account by just clicking on the little link on the left-hand side and recording straight into your computer. No making phone calls, no using that old-fashioned service anymore. Don't forget, we're also on Stitcher, so if you got Stitcher, we're on it. Go to Stitcher right now on your mobile phone and type in Creepercast and listen to us there. No more having to download, it streams right to you. We also have the iTunes sweepstakes going on. Jeff, can you tell people about the iTunes sweepstakes?
The iTunes sweepstakes is that thing that keeps going on and on and on and on until we get 25 reviews on our iTunes pages for either this show or The Walking Dead Weekend Review. And as soon as we get those 25 reviews, whether they're full of love, full of hate, full of suggestions, full of reasons why Jeff should stop laughing while doing the show, there's, anything like that, it doesn't matter. We still put you in the drawing in Jason's proverbial perverted hat. Proverbially perverted. It just has a ring to it that's disturbing. Anyway, if we'll draw one name from either set of 25 and you get to pick your choice of anything of one item out of our Creepercast store.
That's right. So head over to creepercast.com/iTunes or creepercast.com/TWD. iTunes to be able to get in on the sweepstakes.
And don't forget the lucky 26th person gets to be stalked by me.
Yes. Which actually sounds much more appealing than it may be.
Yes.
I promise a good time all around.
For everyone, yes. I'm sure he does.
And you know what? I've been stalked by Mike before. It actually is a good time. All right. And I think with that, let's head on over. To what we're talking about today, and today is J-horror. I always say, whenever I try to say the word horror, it actually sounds more like whore.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we know what's going on in your head.
We know, especially when you put J at the beginning of it.
Yes. All right, so Japanese horror. I want to start off this, rather than talk jumping straight into the films, by talking about the differences, some of the differences between the Japanese culture and the Western culture when it comes to horror films, primarily on the Japanese culture for most of our fans listening in the West. Because really, in order to fully appreciate Japanese horror films, you have to understand where they're coming from with these films, because what they're talking about is very deeply ingrained in the cultural and religious aspects of Japan.
And we have no idea what's going on. So,
well, actually, should we start it with the disclaimer of why we decided to go this route?
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, we decided to go this route where we would discuss the way the Japanese culture, especially when it comes to horror, differs or relates to us, or to the Western, you know, definition of horror. Because Jason and Mike were concerned that they were going to walk into this pretty much saying they hated everything, and I'd be spending the whole time trying to defend Japanese horror. So we figured we would delve into what makes Japanese horror work for them, how it, you know, differs with the way we see things here in the, you know, in the States. And then while we are discussing the films, we can be more objective about what we're talking about.
Right, exactly. And I want to start off by saying the films that we're going to be talking about, I don't think that they're necessarily bad films. I think they're I think they're good films, but the content of them doesn't speak to me because I am not from that culture.
And so we're going to make you a little bit more knowledgeable of that culture.
Right. All right. So the first thing that I want to talk about, though, is that most of the horror films that come out of Japan that at least we tend to see has to do with a there's a certain constant through it, and the constant is a ghost-like creature, and I may butcher this, I'm not sure if I'm saying this correctly, called the Yuri, Y-U-U-R-E-I, the Yuri. And you see this, it's a creature that has a sickly white gray face. In films, in art, normally it's shown without having any legs. The way they get away with that in films is normally by having it flicker rather than walk from place to place. It kind of like jumps gaps in there. Generally, the Yuri is dressed in a white funeral garb with long black hair and outstretched arms with either limp wrists that are hanging down or contorted hands that are in almost a menacing claw-like fashion. And so if you think about some of the films that we'll be discussing today, or some that you may have seen in the past, you'll understand what we're talking about. Case in point, let's go with we'll go with the even the American version of The Ring, where you have the girl who is the Yuri that comes out of the television, and she has long black hair that covers her face. Her arms are outstretched, and her hands, rather than hanging down limply, which tends to be something shown more in their art and comics, such as manga comics, her hands are more claw-like, more demon-like.
Mm-hmm.
And
I thought that was just a coincidence, or that, you know, I'm like, both of these movies that we're talking about tonight, I seen that, I didn't realize that was a typical thing with the Japanese culture.
Right. And actually, the depiction of the Yuri as being like this with the white garb and the black hair and stuff actually doesn't go back that far. The Yuri has been around for centuries, but the look that we see now of it has only been around since the late 19th century. Previous to that, depictions of the Yuri in drawings and paintings show them more as indistinguishable from human beings, with the exception of not having legs.
Yeah, it's only in the recent times, like you just said, especially it actually came about because of an artist depiction that, you know, that made them human like us. But it's the whole point of trying to differentiate
them.
Yeah, differentiate. I don't usually have problems with words. Them enough to where we can tell that they're not us.
Right.
Whereas before, and it's also important to point out that I'm sure we're going to end up talking about, and is that the point of the Yuri, though, is that according to Japanese culture, all spirits are Yuri. There are actually categories of Yuri, and those are the ones that actually make it into these films.
Right. And so how does a spirit turn into one of these vengeful Yuris? One of the main differences between Western culture of ghosts and Eastern culture of Yuris is in the Western culture with ghosts, we tend to see ghosts as somebody stuck in our plane, not moving on to whatever the other realm is, call it heaven, call it whatever, because they have unfinished business and they have to finish that job before they can move on, to where the Yuri gets stuck in our plane based on its emotional state when it died.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have like a vengeful spirit, such as ones that we'll be talking about, then it's because the Yuri was somehow slighted at the end, either murdered or committed suicide in a way because of abuse or neglect or some other reason. There are Yuris that go after only men because she was a woman whose husband basically cheated on her. And so she, you know, tries to punish only men. You have Yuris
And importantly, it's the, you know, what you're pointing out is importantly is that it's not necessarily like in Western spirits, we are under the belief that these ghosts are doing it on their own volition. Whereas the Yuris of Japanese culture are just, you know, it's not of their own volition. They're not doing it because they made a conscious decision to do it. It's because they are trapped in this emotional state.
Right. And in fact, it's believed that they don't have any recollection or anything that has to do with their previous self.
Right.
So what that ends up meaning is that to where ghosts that we're used to, the general thought is that you can either expel it, you know, by having an exorcism of some sort, or you can help it complete its task and it will go away. That's not true for their culture because it doesn't have a task to complete. It's just constantly stuck. There is no way of actually getting rid of it, of stopping it.
Now, at the same time, it also gives us the, you know, something that we use in our culture today that shows supernatural actually is a prime example, is that if part of the reason why they stick around, their ghosts stick around is because maybe their funeral rites, you know, weren't proper.
Yes.
Or if they didn't have proper funeral rites, and one way to get them to pass on is to actually give them the proper funeral rites, which, you know, this, I believe both of the movies that we're going to talk about later involve this.
Right. One thing
and
that's,
Supernatural does it on a regular basis.
Right. One thing that's interesting too, is that as far as the funeral rites, it's a common tradition in binding the body when you bury it so that the Yuri can't escape and is forever stuck inside the ground. And if you don't bind it correctly, that allows the Yuri to escape and go back and haunt or do whatever it needs to do. And whether it's haunting a building or using some sort of technology for its vengeance, that's, you know, one of the main differences. To where in the United States, you know, if someone doesn't have the proper burial rites or something, that's not what actually causes the ghost. The idea is that the ghost happens before the burial itself.
Right. Yeah, pretty much the moment of death.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, unfinished business, you know, is a major difference. Unfinished business versus emotional turmoil is one another major difference. One thing that we'll talk about in here with these two films coming up, and also if you watch the movie The Ring or Ringu, which the only reason they actually put the U at the end in the United States is to differentiate it from The Ring, which they were making at the time, is the spirit's ability to hijack technology. Traditionally, Yuris were confined to a space or a person. So if you were the husband and you murdered your wife, the Yuri would be confined to haunting you. Once you die, then the Yuri, by law of nature, cannot haunt somebody else. So it just does nothing. It wanders the earth but doesn't do anything. So with that, one of the things that has contemporized the Yuri is the technology, and especially since World War II, where they have basically brought outdated stories into contemporary world, because of the rebuilding of Japan after the war of World War II, where we bombed them and everything was bombed and they had to rebuild. And then they became one of the technological leaders in the world. The idea of the Yuri has latched onto this technology
and
used
natural.
That as a yeah. means of travel. And that's how we get many of the films that we have, is because, you know, otherwise the Yuri really isn't that scary of an idea, because as long as basically you don't, if it's confined to a house, you get out of the house. If it's confined to a person, then just don't be that person. Don't murder someone. Don't be, but yes, when it's,
don't be that guy,
don't be that guy. But where a lot of the modern films come in and exploit that is by using technologies such as, we'll talk about the use of a cell phone, video, electricity, water, bathroom, you know, you name it. They hijack modern conveniences, modern technology, and because they connect to that rather than a person or a place, that allows them to travel from one person to the next, to the next, to the next.
Yes.
Okay.
Nobody else was. I figured I had to say something at that point. No, you're absolutely correct. And it wouldn't be true to say that, you know, we haven't westernized that already to a certain extent, because, I mean, you had the movie Shocker, for example.
Right.
Which is, you know, basically using the same concept of the Yuri.
Oh, Lawnmower and American Man.
Or Lawnmower Man, there you go. And just totally modernizing it into the technological age. But as you were saying about the, you know, the this transcendence of the Yuri to get into a more technological way of spreading, happening during World War II when the rebuilding of Japan and Japan becoming a technological hub.
Yes.
It's only natural that their ghosts and their spiritual beliefs would end up infiltrating. And that's kind of that's also another way you can look at the, you know, the Japanese horror films, is that their ghosts are infiltrating things that, you know, they are taking for granted, which is making those things just as scary as, you know, a house would have been if it was haunted.
Right. And that's one of the major differences too, is that our ghosts tend to haunt houses, tend to be, you know, in dank old. You think of ghosts as not being in modern buildings because, you know, it hasn't been around long enough for something tragic to happen or someone to die or anything like that. To where with them, it can be in anything, including a cell phone, including a videotape. And so with that being the case, there basically is nothing that is safe. But one of the big differences is that they have to adhere to certain universal rules. You can't defeat a vengeful spirit like you can in Western culture. We already talked about this earlier. In Western culture, you can exorcise them. You can salt the bones and burn it, as in Supernatural.
You can have the Winchester brothers do it for you.
Yeah. Yes, you can have the Winchester brothers do it for you. You can help it complete its task. And it's spoiler, if you haven't seen the movie Ring, that was the plot for most of the Ring, was that this woman tried to help a Yuri by doing what we would do in Western culture, which is help the Yuri complete its task, thinking that it would move on at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to give away the ending, so skip forward 30 seconds if you haven't seen the ending. But as you see in actually the Japanese version, the Ringu, that's not the case. The case is that you have to adhere to the rules that were depicted when they came about.
Yeah, when it all began.
When it all began. And the point of, in the case of the Ring or Ringu, is that you watch the film 7 days later, this Yuri is going to come out and is going to kill you. And the only way for it not to kill you, it doesn't matter if you destroy the tape, it doesn't matter if you try to help it, the only way to do it is to actually pass on that curse to somebody else, i.e. make a copy of the tape and send that copy to somebody else.
Right. And then it skips, you know, basically you've given the Yuri the opportunity to spread and basically skipping over you.
Right. So exactly. So that's one of the rules, that it doesn't matter what you try to do, you have to adhere to the rules. But at the same time, the Yuri also has to follow rules. If you didn't watch the tape, then it can't come after you. If you didn't, you know, listen to a message, it can't come after you. If you are outside of the building, it can't come after you.
Now, of course, all these conventions have been challenged as well.
Right.
When you think about that, because there are sequels to these films that challenge even the conventions we're talking about.
Right. And that's where the rules are hard for us in the West, because the rules are what are considered universal rules. And in Japanese culture, you can't understand universal rules.
Well, the universe doesn't exist in these rules, because everything is all a part of the same.
Right. And so you can't so it's not us to understand universal rules. So when you try to incorporate logic into the rules and try to figure out why something is the way it is, it doesn't matter, because it's not our rules. The universe made it up. And so both us and the Yuri have to follow it. Otherwise, bad things happen.
But you can't but you can't even bother to try to understand them, like you said, with the logic. You know, using logic and trying to understand them doesn't really do you any good. It's kind of like, you know, when they say God works in mysterious ways. Well, that's the same idea that these films and the Japanese spiritual belief follows, is that you can try to understand them, but you're never going to.
Right. So some other fun Yuris that I was able to look up. One that made me chuckle is called Hanako-san of the Toilet. This is kind of a Japanese version of Bloody Mary. Because Japanese just love to punish you for your basic bodily functions, this urban legend takes place in a washroom. Specifically, the third stall from the end of any elementary school washroom, and in some versions, it's also on the third floor. Unlike previous urban legends or other urban legends where creatures will come at you unprovoked, Hanako needs to be summoned. Through the idea of luring a ghostly little girl into an empty bathroom falls a little further from scary urban legend and closer to, you know, that pedophile on the news last week.
Yeah.
In order to call Hanako, you need to do a very polite thing and knock three times on her stall. This is usually accompanied by calling her out. Are you there, Hanako-san? If you are greeted with the reply, yes, I'm here, and, you know, apart from pissing your pants in terror, you can push open the door stall to reveal Hanako, said to be a little girl with bob black hair and a red skirt. The outcome of your courage differs. Hanako-san will either vanish or, just to, you know, scare more shit out of you, you will be pulled into the toilet and killed. If, on the other hand, you think, well, I just won't answer, or else, you know, if you knock on the stall, receive a reply, and assuming you don't immediately run out the door, you still have the opportunity to walk away if you don't open the door. However, if you insist on cornering the little girl in the toilet stall, you may have just enough time after seeing Hanako to make a break for the exit and escape.
I just want to say this, and this does not reflect on our show or the members of this, but dear Japan, what the hell? Just got a second.
Another one that is kind of similar is called Red Mantle, or Red Cloak. All right. Let's assume for a moment, like many, you enjoy another basic human function of going to the bathroom. Perhaps you had a few too many servings of sake and make a mad dash for the ladies' toilet closest to you. I'm assuming that you're a lady, hopefully. As you enter the bathroom and try to avoid physical contact between your butt and the scurvy-filled toilet seat, you suddenly hear a voice. And the voice says, do you like the red cloak or do you like the blue cloak? After sitting uncomfortably for a few seconds, wondering what possessed someone to break the cardinal rule of keeping their mouth shut during toilet time, you answer, the red cloak, red cloak. According to your answer, there are a variety of, shall we say, hilarious outcomes. If you answered the red cloak, you will be sliced apart like a steakhouse special. According to who's telling the story, your throat may be cut, your hands chopped off, or you will simply be cut into a bunch of tiny little itty-bitty pieces, flown down to the ground with your blood resembling a red cloak. So you may be thinking, well, then I'll just answer the blue cloak. That may be a good idea, except now you take a deep breath, because you're going to need it, when the life is being slowly strangled out of you, the results leaving you completely tongue-lollied face, whatever that means. I think tongue sticking out?
Yeah.
Okay. And your face a deep, deep blue, i.e. the blue cloak. Sitting there in the stall and reminiscing on your options, you may be wondering which of these two you would prefer. Well, fear not, you can actually go with a third option. You can choose neither, and it will spare you a gruesome death.
So the best part is just don't choose.
Right.
And you could survive it. That's funny because it actually feeds on the idea that when people are given choices, they have to pick one.
Yes.
See, it doesn't seem like any choice is a good choice with these, you know, I mean, other than the, you know, not choosing. And I just want to state this one more time, dear Japan, what the hell?
What I like about it, though, is that they're basing it on the assumption that once a person, it's human nature that once given a choice, you're going to pick something.
Yes. Now, mind you, that's all of these are considered Yuris. So.
Yeah.
And somehow they are coming after people depending on how they died.
Hmm.
The last one is called the Split Mouth Woman. Kushisaki Ona, I think that's how you say it. Basically, the moral of most Japanese urban legends seems to consist of don't go anywhere by yourself ever. The story of Kushisaki Ona, the split-mouthed woman, is really no different, except that you are doubtly unfortunate if you happen to be a child. Evidently, she preys on children. If you happen to be a snotty pubescent walking alone one day, you might consider taking a different route if you are suddenly approached by a female figure in a trench coat. I'm just going to throw in there myself. If you're also a child and you're approached by a male figure in a trench coat, don't go near him either. Now, before you assume that this will be a harmless display of kibbles and bits, rest assured, you'll be shown something. Unfortunately, it will not be the coveted boobies. The Kushisaki Ona will appear as a tall woman in a trench coat with long black hair. Again, we're back to that long black hair thing again. Her most telling feature is a surgical mask covering the bottom half of her face. She will approach you and ask you a question. Am I beautiful? If you reply no, your troubles are over, mainly because she will produce a comedically oversized pair of scissors and remove your head. So you may be thinking, I'll just answer yes. In which case, she will remove her mask to reveal her grotesquely mutilated face, her smile sliced from ear to ear, and says, am I still beautiful? If you have some kind of twisted Joker fetish and reply yes, she will take the aforementioned scissors, chase you down, and slice off your head. If you reply no, she will do it anyway. Some people just can't be satisfied, I guess.
So the moral of the story, all of these stories, is if somebody asks you any question, just run away.
Yeah. More or less.
Especially if somebody, if a Japanese ghost asks you a question.
So, but what this tells you is that these are, you know, these are, I mean, think about some of the ghost stories that we have. We have the Hook Man, which is, you know, the moral of the story is don't go out in the woods at night or you do something bad. The Hook Man's out there. You have the Woman in White. You have, what are some of the other kind of folk story ghost stories that we have in the U.S.?
Well, we've talked many times about urban legends and such, so it's... There's thousands of things out there, but usually you're not giving a choice
right.
for one.
Normally,
which is what I think is,
and that's where this is really interesting is that many of these Yuris or the urban legends are based on, as you put it, it's based on a choice that you can never make.
Right. Which is funny, which I think is funny, is that because it's human nature that once we're given a choice, it's kind of like, and we always give choices. You know, that's how we always do that. It's like, well, would you like the red one or the blue one?
The red pill or the blue pill?
Yeah, red pill or the blue pill. And we think that that's our only choice, so we pick one. And that's kind of what the Japanese culture is working on, is that that human need to choose between the two items.
Right.
And that's pretty funny when you think about it.
So with that, I just wanted to end that with a little bit of some of the background on Yuri's and Scary, or the urban legends and some of the stuff that we'll be talking about, so that you have a bit of an understanding when we dive into Juan and however the heck you say the phone one. So with that, any last things
really
you guys want to say?
Yeah, I just want to throw in really quickly the classifications of a Yuri, because it's going to be important to what we're talking about. Mostly because you'll see that the lines are blurred with these classifications, that the Japanese have done a really good job giving us more than one Yuri, usually in most of these films. I'm probably going to butcher names too, because I'm not as great at Japanese as Jason is.
Yeah, because I'm great.
Anyway, we have the Onryo, which is a vengeful ghost who comes back from purgatory. Let's keep in mind that the Japanese believe that all spirits go to purgatory. There isn't a heaven or hell. We all go to purgatory. And given what we've learned about what causes these spirits to come back and cause their business, we have the Onryo, who is a vengeful spirit ghost who comes back from purgatory for a wrong done to them during their lifetime. That's a story that we know really well.
So that would sound kind of like the split-faced woman.
Yes, maybe. I mean, she falls under other ones as well. I'm just going to say Ubumi, because I don't know how that's how you say it, is a mother ghost who died in childbirth or died leaving young children behind. Now, again, the Japanese are not liking of humor, apparently, because this Yuri returns to care for her children and often brings them sweets.
Aw, that's cute.
And then we have the Goryo, which is the vengeful ghost of the aristocratic class, especially those who are martyred. Then we have the Funayuri, if you prefer. These are the ghosts who died at sea. These are the ones that I think are the most entertaining, because there was actually a Masters of Horror episode based on this particular ghost. And these ghosts are sometimes depicted as scaly, fish-like humanoids, and some may even have a form similar to that of a mermaid or a merman. I don't know if you guys remember the Master of Horror episode that had to do with the guy that killed his wife and threw her overboard.
Yes.
And then when he was out on the ocean again later with his, you know, with his current girlfriend, the Funayuri of his dead wife came back. So it's a common one. Okay, and then we have the Zashiki Warashi, which is the ghost of children, often mischievous rather than dangerous. This is an important one to one missed call.
Yes.
Then we have the samurai ghosts, which are veterans of the Genpei War who fell in battle. Now, warrior ghosts usually appear a lot in theater. And unlike most other Yuri, these ghosts usually have legs. And then the split-faced woman, which would be the seductress ghost, or as we know in from Greek and from Greco-Roman mythology, the succubi. Which is the ghost of a woman who initiates a post-death love affair with a living human. So, and then, you know, I mean, madcap hilarity and death and destruction and, you know, decapitations come with any of these ghosts. Which we're going to get into in the next few minutes. Of course, I'm assuming that before we get into that, we're going to get into our other portions of the show.
That's right.
Kind of a let everybody rest their brains from the... from the lesson they just received.
Why don't we head over to Captain Creeper's book corner to see how things are going with a Cthulhu problem.
All right, thanks, guys. Welcome to Captain Creeper's book corner. This week, we have another graphic novel that I stumbled across. And we're doing two graphic novels in a row because Jeff changed the schedule on me, so this isn't my fault.
Oh, you think that's bad? Just wait.
So this week's graphic novel is titled North 40, and it's authored by a gentleman named Aaron Williams. It's about 144 pages long, and it came out November 16th, 2010. Basic plot of this graphic novel is that the residents of an isolated rural area discover... superhuman and supernatural power in their midst, but the power stops at the county line. Inside the afflicted area, something ancient and malevolent, thank you, stirs and new monsters arise. The series concentrates on young Wyatt, an unlikely hero from the wrong side of the tracks, as well as Sheriff Morgan and his odd past, and town outcast Amanda. They'll have to combine their efforts to keep the county free from imploding or being eaten by the mighty Cthulhu. Okay, so my dislikes and likes on this. I thought this was a very well done graphic novel. Usually when you're dealing with the Cthulhu mythos, it's just bad things happening, people dying and going insane. And while there certainly is that in this story, as well as people being turned into unholy and ungodly monsters, Williams actually gives the other side a chance by giving some of the characters powers of their own to fight the darkness. I really enjoyed the artwork, especially since in other forms of literature and in films, it's almost impossible to capture Cthulhu because of its very abstract nature, and that's just the way it's defined. It's beyond human comprehension, and I thought the artist did a really good job of portraying that. The downside of that is the piece of Cthulhu that we do see is somewhat like of an looks like an Illithid or a Mind Flayer from Dungeons and Dragons. All right, Google it for God's sakes. I can't do all that here. And the problem that I have with this is it's somewhat wordy at times, and it kind of bogs the story down. You know, it's a graphic novel. I should be able to just look at it and, you know, get what's going on with minimal, you know, and of course you want dialogue, obviously. But if it's so much, it was almost like, you know, reading a Stephen King novel where he tends to take three pages to describe what you and I could do in a couple of sentences. And I get that some of the characters are hillbilly rednecks, and so is the rest of the family. But the way they're drawn or how they speak and act, I got that. I didn't need extra sidebar paragraphs telling me repeatedly that they were redneck hillbillies. And my biggest problem with this is that it's over. It only ran as a 6-issue miniseries. It could have been so much more. And in fact, the ending leads you to believe that there will be more. It literally states to be continued. Nothing's really resolved in the 6-issue story arc. So it really leaves you dangling. And after doing some digging, and yes, you jerks, I do know how to do research. it's been stated that that's all there is and or ever will be. So this makes me sad. I give it a 4 out of 5, and it is available for paperback. I believe you can get it on Amazon. So, and that's Captain Creeper's Book Corner this week.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
My pleasure.
And now let's head over to see what's going on this week in TV. All right, this week in horror TV, at least the end of Fringe didn't involve a snow globe. After 5 years, J.J. Abrams' Fringe is over, and it went out more with a whimper than a roar. This past Friday was the series finale of Fringe. Its fifth season only had 13 episodes to wrap everything up, which was probably good in that it was a little lackluster. It's hard talking about the series finale without giving away spoilers, but I'll give it a try. This season took us into the future, where the Observers took over the world and all but enslaved the human race. The only people to stop them are Peter, Walter, and our gang of fringe detectives, who spent the last 20 years trapped in suspended animation from their invention of Amber. If you don't know, don't ask. Throughout the final season, the Fringe gang followed a plan Walter came up with to rid the world of the Observers. I don't think I'm giving anything away by saying it worked, but it's how it worked that is neither remarkable or totally unique. It was certainly fun and exciting to watch Olivia and Peter infiltrate the Observers' headquarters with the help of the combination of remnants of cases they worked on in the first two or three seasons. It was a great way to acknowledge the fans that have followed the show from the beginning. You had Peter, you had killer hallucinations, spontaneous combustion, worms popping out of people's bodies, mouth sealing shut, heads exploding, etc., etc. And after spending 5 years waiting for Peter, played by Joshua Jackson, and Anna Torv's Olivia to live happily ever after, the conclusion was a very, very sweet slap in the face. But hey, at least it didn't involve a snow globe.
Was it the island?
It wasn't an island either. Supernatural returns from winter break. You know, for Sam and Dean Winchester being brothers, this past Wednesday's episode had kind of a strange bromance thing going on. I'm starting to get a feeling that the new showrunner, Jeremy Carver, lied just a little bit when he said season 8 was going to have the feel of the beginning. Sam and Dean on the road, saving damsels in distress from spirits, creatures, and demons. Yeah, not really happening. Instead, the season has become a weird romantic triangle between Sam, Dean, and whoever that week is trying to break them up. We come back from break to see that Sam is still in Texas, where Naomi gives him an ultimatum to stay with her or go back to his brother. Basically, it's her or Dean. All that while Dean is tempted to cheat on Sam with his new beau, the emo vamp Bernie. So the drama of the episode came from Sam and Dean's bromantic brotherly relationship, and everything else was kind of treated as background noise, such as being able to hack into an Angel's operating system to reveal the boot sector. Yeah, it sounds as absurd as it was, but kind of fun to think about it, really. So does that mean Castiel's brain is basically running nothing more than Raspberry Pi? It's okay, Mike, I know you don't get the reference.
Yeah, no.
The show always knew there was a strange homoeroticism to the brothers. They even referenced it a few seasons ago. And it's normally just ignored, at least by me. But come on, let's put the brotherly angst behind us and make the rest of the season about the bad guys we love to see killed. That's all I'm asking for. And finally, Zombieland is coming to television. Maybe. As you may recall, the 2009 horror comedy Zombieland was pitched to CBS as a television series. After being passed on, Columbus, Tallahassee, Wichita, and Little Rock broke expectations and maybe even some records by battling zombies on the big screen. Well, it seems things have come full circle. That's right, we may soon have a contender for the zombie kill of the week. According to our friends over at io9.com, Zombieland just sent out casting calls for the show's main characters. There's little being released right now about when the show will air. We also don't know much about the plot. Will we, well, we sort of do, thanks to the film, but we don't know if it'll be a reboot with our characters and start right from the beginning when the zombie slash mad cow disease breakout happens, or if it starts off where the film ends. We know our four city characters will be back and doubt they'll be portrayed by the actors from the film. And that's what happened this week in horror news.
And I just want to say it's about time we have a Zombieland sequel.
And yes, in case you're wondering, watch Supernatural this past week. It's on Hulu Plus right now. They do crack into an angel's brain like it was, you know, a Mac OS X.
I haven't watched it yet, so that's usually my Monday morning treat.
All right, let's head on to Jeff's news.
Okay, this week in the news, I'm actually going to concentrate on something that was, this weird coincidence that happened this week. An item that was in my news was recently discussed on our Facebook page, which you can see at facebook.com/creepercast, in which we are glad that Mike was able to convince a certain somebody. I don't know how much convincing he actually did. He probably did more begging, got down on his knees and said, hey, you should check out the Creepercast. But anyway, thank you, Tasia, for joining the cast and for pointing out VHS, which I haven't talked about enough, apparently. But I'm going to talk about more. In fact, I'm going to talk about the sequel entitled SVHS, which only seems natural, right?
Well, yeah, because, you know, when we're talking about cables and stuff, you know, and that's, yeah.
Well, I mean, in this case, we're talking about VHS tapes actually did lead to SVHS tapes, which were supposed to take over the medium.
Well, yeah, and but then DVD came out right at the same
right,
time.
Right, which does make an interesting question. Will the third one actually be DVD? Anyway, from the reason why SVHS is in the news is because it is completed. In fact, they just did a first showing at Sundance just a few days ago, basically. Well, today, in fact, is when this article was posted, so it must have been the other day, that basically they're telling us that SVHS is a leaner, but totally crazier, gorier, scarier, wilder, funnier follow-up to VHS in every single way. Now, if you've read anything that I've said about it, I've said that it's pretty good all the way around. But if that doesn't tell you anything, or that little, you know, one-liner that I just gave you doesn't tell you anything about SVHS and the fact that they just called it SVHS, that let's look at some of the filmmakers that are involved, like Simon Barrett of who is the writer of Your Next. We have Jason Eisner from Hobo with a Shotgun, another movie that Jason and I have mentioned often. We have Greg Hale from Say Yes Quickly, and back into the limelight yet again, Eduardo Sanchez. Yes, that's right, the man who brought us The Blair Witch Project. And then, of course, Adam Wingard, because you can't have a VHS, you know, you can't have a found footage film full of found footage films without the found footage king of today. But
that's a
anyway,
lot of found footage.
Yeah, exactly. But apparently it looks like this, and I did watch the trailer, which doesn't give away a lot, obviously, because, you know, it's... But essentially the idea is the same. We have four films. We have four short films with another film that wraps them all together somehow. Or at least, you know, something to that expect. Anyway, from what I've read, they are promising, gorier, insane, and scary as hell. Which I do believe that, you know, I strongly believe there are some good scare scenes in VHS. And they're pushing the envelope on the found footage aspect, which I think is great. Because that's... If you've read anything that I've written before or heard me talk about it, is that there became things that we could know beyond any doubt was going to happen. The show The River, pretty much, you know, I mean, talk about beating the hell out of the formula known as found footage. That show did it on a daily basis.
At least the daily basis didn't last long.
Yeah, yeah, at least it's over now. But from what I understand and everything I've read about it is that they're really treating it as an experiment, and they don't have any boundaries to be limited by. So I like that idea, and I'm hoping that they'll continue it as well as they did with the first film. And I really am I really am excited for a crazier, insaner, funnier, found footage collection, if you will. Next on the list was Mama. You know, I haven't had a chance to go out and see this one yet, but nothing makes me more excited to see a movie than to find out that Guillermo del Toro was somehow behind it. And, of course, this movie, Mama, which involves, looks kind of like a ghost film, a supernatural thriller at least, that tells of a haunting tale of two girls who disappeared into the woods the day that their mother died. Basically, their dad went crazy, killed their mom, and killed himself while they were living in a cabin. Now, I've read a lot of bad things, I've read a lot of good things, The thing to keep in mind is this one is based on a short film that was originally put together by director Andre Muschietti and cinematographer Antonio Riestra. And somehow they convinced Guillermo, you know, well, they didn't take much convincing, apparently. Guillermo del Toro saw it and said, this needs to be a full-length feature. And thus, we have a full-length feature now. I'm kind of interested in seeing it. I haven't heard tons of bad things, although I do understand that they kind of mess with a lot of, you know, horror movie conventions, if you will. And some of them seem like they might, you know, kind of leak to the films we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. Last but not least, your voice for independent horror, that's right, the Horror Society, is preparing their awards for 2013, and they need your help deciding what is the best film, the best sci-fi film, best short film, best web series, best director, favorite death scene, favorite scream queen, and more importantly, favorite scream king, which is pitting our friend Bill O'Burst Jr. against the ever-present Malcolm McDowell.
You know what I have to say is, hasn't McDowell earned enough? Give it to Bill.
Right. Let's have Bill have it. I mean, I'm down with that.
I think he'll be okay taking second once in a while.
Well, Malcolm, yes. I mean, come on. Take second to Bill? How hard could that be to handle?
I'll take second to Bill any day.
You have this weird fixation on Bill, and I think you need to, you and your wife, and maybe Bill need to go to, you know, some sort of marriage counseling thing.
Now, here's the sad thing about this list, actually, though. When I made my, you know, I'm going to make a declaration here, an admission, if you will, that there's very little on this list that I know. On these lists for, you know, best directors and, you know, the films in particular, which is telling me that we need to watch a lot more independent films, because most of them are independent films. So
I mean, basically what you're going to do is you're just going to take all of the films off of this and start going down the list for us, right?
Absolutely. Except for Evil Dead, because I don't think we really want to talk about that one. No. The remake.
Okay, true.
And that is the news, and I will, of course, post the link to the Horror Society website so you can vote for Bill, too, because I know that Jason and I have.
Yes.
And since you can't vote for me, and I am the creepiest guy out there, vote for Bill.
Hello, Captain Creeper.
You can't trust anybody that calls themselves the captain. Can you really, though?
That's true. I mean, if you self-titled,
I'm not the one who came up with it.
That's true. That's true, Jason. That was your call.
Oh, I just went along with him.
Went along with him.
Like, oh, okay, if you want to be called the captain, okay. Can no, I be called actually, the colonel?
Actually, I think we need to, like, we need to rewind back to a few episodes and see for sure. Somebody do that for us. Send us the clip. Send us the clip in which Jason said, I know what we're going to call you, Captain Creeper. Which I'm pretty sure is what you said. Maybe,
yeah, okay.
I might be changing the words a little, but... Meanwhile,
anyways,
I think with that, let's head into our films. Jeff, since you're the one that wanted to talk about these films, you know, as they are, why don't you kind of give the story on why you chose them and how you want us to format this?
Well, the two films that I chose are pretty well, one of them is pretty obvious. I mean, it's Ju-on or The Grudge, which is probably the most popular transition that a film has ever done from Japanese horror into the American mainstream.
Besides The Ring.
Other than The Ring, exactly. I have canons, and there's a reason why we don't talk to certain movies, because I figure they're in the canon. Everybody knows them. That kind of falls that way with me for The Ring. And I look at The Grudge really as the best transition, because it involves the original director and one of the original actors was involved in both variations of the film. And then we're doing One Missed Call, because that's one that's really came under the wire. I mean, it didn't really make any money as a Japanese film. It didn't make any money as an Americanized version of the film. And it also set the trend for what's happening to a lot of Japanese horror now when it gets translated into, you know, to American audiences. Now, of course, instead of attacking them like we normally do, which is dissecting every film, you know, dissecting each film from beginning to end. We're actually going to treat them as a body of work and talk more about the comparison and contrasting aspect instead of going through the actual story elements. Because if you want to see the film, you're going to get an idea of what there, you know, what there is worth seeing about them by listening to us compare and contrast.
Right. Now, I do want to throw out, as far as One Missed Call goes, it actually got 0% on Rotten Tomato and was nominated in 2000, or gave it in 2008. It was awarded, not nominated, the Moldy Tomato Award for the worst film of the year.
And keep in mind, that's also, like, you know, a good portion of that is based on the fact that very few saw it.
Yeah, it only had 78 reviews.
Yeah.
So
which one do we want to start with?
With that,
do we want to start with this?
Let's go into the garage. Well, let's go into One Missed Call.
Okay.
Because I already mentioned
Chikushinari.
Akushinari. So I'm going to play the American trailer when we kind of play it, because it doesn't make much sense playing the Japanese trailer for at least people in the U.S. So in this remake of the Japanese horror film, what Jeff said, Akushinari.
Yeah.
Several people start receiving voicemails from them, their future selves, messages which include the date, time, and some detail about how they're going to die. And I'm not going to go into director and stuff because we're talking about the body of work, but I will play the trailer.
That's not my ringtone.
You have one new message.
That's your voice. That's you. Dying. Ever since that bizarre phone call, I keep seeing things.
Leanne got a phone call, and so did Shelly, right before they died.
The girl's right. There's got to be some kind of connection here.
It's like you get a voicemail.
Call came in 2 nights ago.
You hear your death.
They get your head back.
And then you die.
Look, these things work here. They get your head back.
I'm going to be next.
I'll keep you safe. Any dead people call, we're not home.
This girl needs protection.
Everybody seems to be linked together somehow. We could trace it back to the source and find out who started this.
All right, so this film, this set of films, whatever you want to call it, is basically, when we're talking about the Yuri, this depicts on how if a Yuri dies in the way in which they die, i.e. if they were near a phone trying to make a phone call, anything like that, that the Yuri gets trapped in the phone signals themselves.
Yes. In this person did, yes.
Yes. So, I don't really know where to start with this. I will say that, again, I don't care for this type of film. So for me, I didn't like these films, but that's not anything against the filmmakers themselves or that they did necessarily a bad job. I think, some of the acting in the American version was a little lackluster, especially by actors that we know very well, such as Shannon Sossaman.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in that case, I liked the Japanese version better, much better. In both cases, I liked the Japanese version better. But I think that's because I had lower expectations for the acting because I didn't know the people that were acting in the films.
That's actually a really good point. Another thing that you can look at, too, is story structure. And I think what concerns me or interests me most, especially with both of these films, is how they've tried to Americanize or Westernize the spiritual aspect. Like in the original film, especially, you had, it was much slower, tenser pacing,
right,
and less spectacle. And a little bit of spectacle you would get is one of the things I find the most amazing about Japanese horror is that a lot of the spectacle you get is devoid of special effects for the most part.
Right.
So,
I do love that, you know, in the American version, whenever you had the Yuri traveling across, you know, moving towards a person, they always did that little flicker effect, to where in the Japanese version, they just, it's like stop motion. They just cut it.
Right. Yep. And that's, well, and that's the American or the Western version is trying to emulate that, but give it a little bit more of a creepy feel, which is, unfortunately, when we get into The Grudge, that's where that originates from. But because they thought, you know, our Western filmmakers think that that's what they were attempting was a flicker, when actually it was more film cuts, or in, like, you know, when we get into The Grudge, it's more. And we could talk about with One Missed Call. I mean, we have a girl twisting her head off in the original version.
Right.
You know, in the Japanese version. And the best thing about that film is that they really use a contortionist to do that. The only thing special effects about it is the head that rolls across the floor. I mean, that girl really could move that way.
That's cool. And it's kind of like in the episode of The Walking Dead where they crush the one walker's arm. And
yeah, and it was because the guy could actually dislocate.
Yeah. He could dislocate his elbow, and so they didn't do any special effects to make it bend that way.
Which I think is one of the great things. The other big difference that you have between the two films, especially, like I said, is the way they dealt with the subject matter. And I'm torn a lot of times, especially with this one, because I'm a firm believer that when you're watching, you know, a remake of a film, it's usually how you feel about them is based on which one you watch first, if you watch the remake first or the original first. I watched the remake first, and though I agree with the acting, especially when you're, you know, some of the people. I mean, we had the guy from, you know, oh, crap, I'm losing.
Oh, you mean Edward Burns?
Yeah. I mean, we had him in there.
From Saving Private Ryan. And
yeah. And yeah. Then we had, you know, the dude from, I'm going to call him Dougie Mac because that's the last thing I saw him in. It was FDR, American Badass.
Oh, Ray Wise. But,
yeah, there we go. I mean, we had, and actually Wise was really good at his character.
Wise is great with any character, though.
Yeah.
His was so small.
And I love the major scenes that are horribly different, in my opinion, and I know it was because of the Western aspect, is when in the Western version they went for the evangelical minister on TV going to exorcise the demon, whereas in the Japanese version they really stuck to their, you know, spiritual culture, and you had like the five, you know, the four different spiritual, you know, leaders in Japan who are involved in supposed to help, you know, exorcise this spirit. And but then at the same time you're like, well, don't you guys know anything about the Yuri?
Yeah. And that is one of the things, though, that you know, when I was watching this, especially One Missed Call, is when they had the exorcism part, at least with the American version, you can, you know, it's easy to say, well, they're trying to get rid of it the same way that you would any spirit in Western culture, which
added a really humorous aspect to it.
Right. But yeah, you're right. When you're looking at it from the other culture, they know that you can't exorcise a Yuri.
You would think they would know that.
Now, what I got with the Yuri is that, at least from the stuff that I read, is that though you can't exorcise it, what you can do is try to trap it.
Huh.
So that because you can't get rid of it, you can actually kind of, you know, almost bind it so that you can't.
Right. Okay.
It so this could be traveling.
This could be a circumstance too, then, where you've mentioned, you know, and on your Facebook, and, you know, a little bit here, is that not understanding the culture makes it harder to watch these films. And in that particular circumstance, we don't really know what they were trying to do.
Right.
And if they took it seriously or not, because they looked very serious. And there was a lot of, I mean, it was actually a longer film. It was a slower paced film. They went more for tension than scare, because the more tension you build, then when you get that little scare, it's scarier. And that's what they, especially with that scene, because it was like a 30-minute scene just on that alone.
Right. To where in the American version, it was maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah. So it moved a lot. The pacing was a lot faster for that area of it. Now, then we've got the other thing, though, we've talked about, which is the, you know, how easy it is to get rid of the Yuri. And we got a happy ending with the, you know, with the Western version for the most part.
A happy-ish ending.
Happy-ish ending. Whereas
I'd
with
say it wasn't really happy. I mean, yeah, we got a survivor, but you know, she didn't stop it. You know,
right? It skipped over. It skipped on.
Right. Yeah, and so that,
more people
again,
are going to die.
Which is the point that, you know, Jason brought up at the beginning of the show when we were talking about it, especially with Ring and Ringu, is that that's, you know, the way we've and really we're looking at, what is it, Final Destination. I mean, this is, it's kind of the same concept, is that, okay, you can skip somebody and eventually it might even come back to her. You don't know.
Right.
And there are sequels, I mean, on both sides of the ocean on this one, and with all these movies, actually. I lost my train of thought on one of the things I was going to say, but I think Mike needs the chance to talk anyway.
I really don't have much to say. I mean, it's the same thing for me as it is with, you know, Jason, you know, not understanding the cultural significance. Literally when I was watching the Japanese version of this film, and I kind of mentioned this before we started the show, I don't know if it's just the version that we're getting, you know, or it's my monitor or whatever, but there were literally some scenes that I'm watching that were so dark, so badly lit, I had no idea what was going on. But it took me 3 hours to watch this film, and I still had 30 minutes to go when I gave up. I just couldn't get behind. You know, when I watch a movie, you know, whether it's sci-fi or horror or whatever, you know, you get invested in the characters. And
you have that suspension of disbelief. That
right. You know, but you this, after 3 hours, I'm like, you know what? I don't care who dies, honestly. Yeah. You know, I just want something to happen. And I just couldn't find myself getting, you know, emotionally connected to any of these characters. And I know part of it is that whole cultural thing. And again, not saying, you know, again, agreeing with Jason, as far as I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I just didn't care for it.
Well,
either
then
actually.
I always pick a, you know, I'm a purist and I've said this many times, so I'm always, almost always anyway, pick the original over the westernized versions. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that I don't have any qualms to, if I don't understand something, you know, learning as much about it as possible. And I did already have a lot of understanding of the Japanese spirit culture. But
well, as did I, but just having understanding of it, to me, isn't enough. Where the real horror of any Japanese film like this comes in, I mean, leaving out something like Audition, which doesn't have to do with the spirit culture,
right.
You know, when it has stuff to do with the spirit culture over there, though, first of all, I don't get behind a lot of ghost movies anyway, because of the fact that, you know, you have to have a belief in ghosts in order for it to have any effect on you to begin with. And then when you take this, even having an understanding, I understand the culture and the Yuri and how deeply ingrained it is. But at the same time, just understanding that, I can appreciate what they're going for, but it has no effect on me at all.
Okay. Huh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does make sense.
And I think that's what's going to happen with most people when they watch these films. That's why this did so bad. That's why The Grudge, even for being one of the bigger films, you know, Japanese remakes, still didn't do that great.
True. Well, the only thing I have to say about this, you know, outside of the fact that I think that, you know, for those of you out there who are like me and, you know, want to see the original and get annoyed by Hollywood versions of the originals, is that, especially with this one, Mike, I'm going to say that you missed an interesting, you know, twist ending then, mm-hmm, by not finishing the film, because they actually pushed the, you know, their Yuri aspect that they dealt with was, let, you know, as long as the Yuri gets to finish its mission in life, then, you know, everybody else is safe. And that's pretty much the way the original film ended. Whereas our westernized version did the skip over technique, which I liked. I kind of liked it more in the original because it's, you know, kind of placating, but at the same time, the terror continues for one person. And then, but again, I also have problems with the, you know, we as a, in the Western world or in Hollywood films, we like to pick up pacing. We want the scares to be faster. We want the story to be faster. We want our, you know,
well, and they added a lot more of a mystery aspect to it.
Yeah. Well, there was a lot of exposition in the, you know, in the original film. But so honestly, I spent a lot of time going back and watching just the scenes that were supposed to be creepy to see if they really were as, you know, that creepy without the buildup. And to me, they are. I mean, but.
Well, and I'm just going to the only other thing I want to say, and this is just me, and you know this about me, because every time you make me watch one of these movies, I complain about it. I hate subtitles. Just saying.
Right. Well, and I think in a film like this one, especially with One Missed Call, especially, the subtitles are really secondary to the story. You only need them in order to know, you know, exactly, you know, what's happening at that particular moment. If you can look at it and go, oh, so-and-so is doing this, and then you watch it happen. And then, you know, like every 10 minutes, you have to look down.
I will tell you one thing that this, that I think both these movies, but really more the Japanese version, did for me, is made me not want to look out the peephole on my front door.
Now, my biggest complaint about the Westernized version too, though, and this happens all the time, especially with foreign films, is that there's elements that they allude to but never explain. Whereas in the original version, we understand, you know, or we have a, actually, they explain it, but they know we don't have a culmination of it. Is the, you know, we don't get the catharsis. Like the whole reason why she won't look through the peephole, the reason why she's so afraid of looking through the peephole, is we got a great explanation of why she doesn't like looking through the peephole in the Western version, but never a catharsis to that.
Right.
Whereas in the original, you know, in the Japanese version, there was catharsis.
Right.
and things like that. And, you know, let's move this along then to the, you know, the, to the film that, other than The Ring, was the big, supposed to be the big Western adaptation.
Right. And that would be The Grudge. And I'm going to go with the what the American IMDb says about the American remake. The American remake is an American nurse. Now, in the original, it's just a nurse. But in the remake, an American nurse living and working in Tokyo is exposed to a mysterious supernatural curse, one that locks a person in a powerful powerful rage before claiming their life and spreading to another victim. What kind of Yuri would this be? Jeff, do you have your list up in front of you, or did you close it?
I did close it, but that's still that's your vengeful spirit.
Right.
So.
But this is what's great about this one, though, is this is a twist in that it's not just one vengeful spirit. It's that it spreads to another to another to another.
Well, right. And you also have like three, you actually have three Yuris pretty much in this one, because you have the vengeful spirit, you have the spirit that's, you know, bent on destruction, and then you have the child spirit.
Right. And the child spirit is actually more mischievous than anything.
Right.
So here's the trailer for The Grudge. That's not going to tell you anything. I'll tell you that right now. Now, the trailer basically depicts what the movie is, i.e., you don't need Sarah Michelle Gellar or Jason Baer to actually talk throughout this film, because the whole crux of the film isn't even the main characters. It's the special effects that they do.
Yeah, even though they did do a really good job trying to avoid special effects in some circumstances. Again, this is a case where the actor that played the ghost woman is the same one who's also is the same one from the original and is a contortionist. So a lot of that stuff where she was contorting was not effects.
Right. Again, this is another one that, I think the Japanese version did better than the American version for a couple different reasons. One is that, again, I didn't know the actors in the Japanese version. The American version has Sarah Michelle Gellar, aka Buffy. You had Jason Baer, who has played on Roswell. You had Clea DuVall. Is that how you say her name? Clea? Cly?
Yeah.
She's been on a lot of things, including The Faculty and Identity. And so when you put all that together, you're expecting, I mean, it sounds like a great cast with great acting, but acting was stale.
Let's ask that question that you and I actually asked each other not that long ago is, has Sarah Michelle Gellar ever been in anything besides Buffy in which she was good?
Scooby-Doo.
But if you think about it, her mannerisms and stuff and a lot of Scooby-Doo were very reminiscent of the first two seasons of Buffy.
And then it was another circumstance like what happened to me with Wrong Turn is that I'm watching Wrong Turn the whole time going, but your Faith, get up and kick his ass. And then when you're watching Buffy do this and you're just like, doesn't Giles have a plan for this one? Come on.
Yeah, Giles, look through your book somewhere. Yeah.
It's like, Giles, look through a book. Come on.
Right. But and so with that, the other thing that I liked about the Japanese version compared to the American version is the Japanese version actually was more low key in the film itself. You know, the American version, you know, it's this big bustling city. It's all high rises. It's, you know, modern this. The Japanese version was like, you know, you could tell they were in a, you know, populated area, city area. But at the same time, it was the houses were more of a traditional style.
Yeah. Well, and Ju-on was really a low budget film, and it was a story that was told to you in vignettes.
Right. Yeah.
So it wasn't like you were getting what The Grudge tried to do is take all those vignettes and combine them into flashbacks and, you know, continuous story aspects, but still concentrate on one main character.
Right. And again, The Grudge spent too much time, in my opinion, trying to make more of a mystery out of it than it should have been, to where Ju-on, you just accepted it for what it was. And the characters accepted what was happening for what it was.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there was I'm also torn at the same time because, like I said, this is the same director did the Japanese version and did this one. And he was basically approached by Sam Raimi because Ju-on was, you know, Sam Raimi was so blown away by Ju-on that he went to Takashi Shimizu and said, hey, we want to help you make this into a Hollywood film. And Takashi was like, well, that's fine as long as I get to direct it. And he gets to bring what's her name over with him.
Right.
Now, I think part of the failings in this film didn't really have anything to do with the storytelling aspect, even though from what I understand, Takashi had a lot of problems dealing with the Hollywood people on how to approach the story because they wanted a clear, succinct storyline. And he really wanted to stick more to the mystical aspect of the spirit world and not explain it. Which is what we do.
Right. Well, and that's, like I say, that's a big difference between American horror and Japanese horror and any other kind. You know, you have to remember horror stories, horror films, legends are creations of the society in which they were born. So if you don't have that background from that society, then you're not going to have the appreciation or the ingrained fear that somebody else is going to have.
True. Now, I would argue the point, though, as to whether or not this film has, especially the American version, and I'm going more from the, you know, obviously, I think the original version is probably creepier because of the bareness of it.
Yes.
And the lack of special effects. and the fact that these people really were doing creepy things, especially that particular woman. But there's, even today though, I can sit and watch, and it's mostly with women. Well, keep that in mind as well. I can sit and watch the film and watch them legitimately be creeped out by
right,
a lot of the stuff that
happens.
Are they
creeped out from the content that he's talking to, or that they're showing, or is it the spooky jump scares?
It's more from what I get, it's more the spooky jump scares. Yeah. It's also the indicators. The indicators are what seems to creep people out the most. And it used to be a fun joke of mine to walk into a room with somebody that I know have seen The Grudge that has told me many times that noise that the woman makes is really creepy and starts to creep them out. So I always think it's fun to sit across the room and go, but...
Well, it's no different than my wife can't stand when I sit in the car. Or I, we're sitting on the couch or something, and I just start going, kick, 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 kick. So, and so by seeing it, yes, you do get freaked out like that. Like I said before, and we've talked so many times, though, to get a full appreciation, you have to understand the idea of the Uries. And how they differ and what their meanings are, because then you understand the motivation behind them. And without that motivation,
which is the problem with The Grudge.
Right. And without understanding the motivations behind them, right now, all they are is, just a bunch of, ghosts in a house that like to do crazy, weird things with people, like sticking arms out of the back of your head.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I agree with that. And that's, of course, why we're here. I mean, we gave a lesson at the beginning, and now we're talking about, why we, approach the films the way we did and why we feel the way we do about them now. I do want to point out that the film was made for $10 million and it has made recently, or box office-wise, made a lot more than that. So it kind of gives you an indication as to where this one went, and it did spawn a couple of horrible sequels that even Takashi himself refuses to be identified with. So even though he continued to make sequels, Japanese sequels, which he has no problem identifying with, which kind of tells you a little bit about how he felt about his Hollywood experience. And this is the film, I think, other than The Ring again, where you see them desperately trying to take a concept like the Uri and the rest of, the people with the money didn't understand the concept well enough to be able to make the transcendence into Western culture.
Now, the question is, though, is would going with his original, reshooting it, basically, would that have made it better, or would it have made it worse? Because the one thing that the Hollywood people knew is the American culture. He did not understand the American culture.
Well, that wasn't the problem. Takashi didn't want to do a complete reshoot. He wanted to basically expand the storyline.
Right.
Which is what he thought they were expecting from him. What everybody else wanted to do was just westernize it. So make the spirits more identifiable to Western culture. And that's what he was having the hardest problem with, is that, it's like, well, it takes a lot of exposition to explain how you should understand this in Western culture. And then they would change things enough, other people would change the script enough to where he was like, but this isn't what this isn't what the movie's about.
Right.
But who's at fault there? That's the real question is it because we shouldn't be trying to convert it? We should be trying more to understand their culture, or should he have worked harder to convert it to ours?
Well, I think, whenever you're looking at films from around the world, with the exception of France, Japan is the next big market for films of their own country that don't come out of the U.S. So France, really, in most places in the world, movie theaters are packed with, Hollywood films, except for, they're packed with Hollywood films in Japan, but with the exception of horror films. And so I think that, the Japanese see American horror films the same way that we see Japanese horror films. To them, I don't think that, A Psycho Living Next Door quite has the same tonal aspect as it does for us, because, you know, we live in a society here in the U.S. where we want to feel safe living in our big McMansion in the middle of.
Well, yeah. And to them, it's just a person next door.
Right. And whereas so, you know, it has a completely different feel and tone. So I don't think it even has to do with the fact that we should learn and understand, therefore appreciate. It's the fact that it just doesn't translate.
See, I don't know if I would go that far. And actually, I would challenge people to try to understand the culture better. It's kind of like when you talk about comedy and you talk about British comedy. And we've kind of mentioned that with the Shaun of the Dead, and Mike's mentioned it in a book review, is that, you know, it's hard to understand some of the cultural references. And I would actually challenge people that that's your opportunity then to be more culturally understanding, is to learn these references, try to get more into it, and don't let the Hollywood norm convince you that that's all you have to accept. Yes, I jumped on a soapbox. It's like, fine. Don't let the propaganda run you.
Okay. Mike, I think give you the last word before we head into our ending, before we play the music.
Well, and again, you know, what I've already said, I just didn't care for either version of these movies. And I actually had a note, and I'm not sure if it applies to both movies, but I kind of felt like I was watching a Tarantino film as opposed to whatever, because of the jumping around, especially the Japanese version, because it jumped from vignette to vignette. And I'm like, I have no idea what the hell's going on.
I will admit, and I will agree with you. The first time I've watched Ju-on, this is probably the third or fourth time I've watched it. And the first time that I did watch it, I felt the exact same way.
And, you know, and I don't remember, and this, honestly, and it's probably my own fault, but it speaks to, you know, how much these movies did not capture my attention. I don't remember exactly how Ju-on ended, but the part of the ending in The Grudge was, you know, complete stereotypical Hollywood, and it bothers me. You know, he went to, he knows the house is haunted, and there's evil spirits or whatever, and he goes to burn it down, and he hears a noise, and instead of just lighting the bitch up, he goes to investigate. You know, and it's like, dude, just burn it down.
Because that's what you have to do in a horror film. When you hear a noise, you have to investigate.
See, and that's
why... And as everybody has learned from Amityville Horror, burning the house down doesn't help anyway. It'll be back.
That's true, well, too. Yeah. That's true, too. Now, in the respect of the Yuri, though, burning the house down may actually get rid of it if the Yuri is connected only to the house.
Which, in the Japanese version, to me, it seemed that's what it was. You know, it was right. Because of the violence that took place in the house.
Right, and that's why they couldn't affect people outside of it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, and obviously the American version was different in that the ghost followed, you know, whoever happened to step into the house.
Especially when there became sequels that, like, took over whole apartment buildings and such.
Oh, well, see.
That they actually attached to a person instead of the house itself.
But, yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, but one of the things I liked the most about the Ju-on was that it was only 1 hour and 7 minutes long.
Time frame does help. No, I think I do agree, though. Ju-on was perfect time that, you know, as... Bill Oberst put it, you know, a movie is only as long as it needs to be to tell the story.
Right. And as I mean, like I said, I didn't really like either one of, you know, whether the American version or the Japanese version of either or all four of these movies. But Ju-on was very succinct. And even though, like I said, I'm halfway through the movie and I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. The simple fact that it didn't drag it out. Whereas The Grudge was a good half hour longer. And I was just like, I guess I appreciate the fact that they told their story. And even though half the time I didn't know what was going on, they told it and they were done. They're out. You know, there was no dragging it on, you know, and you've both listened to me complain about, you know, wanting time back for movies. And that's unfortunately a lot of the Hollywood stuff that we watch, there's more exposition than what needs to be there, you know, and they're going for the scare or the, you know, they want you to be more connected to the character by giving you background or whatever. It's like, you know what? I don't need that. Just give me what I, you know, need to get the story and be done. And so.
Right. Exactly. All right. I think with that, let's head into the music and get the frog out of here. All right, well, that was our podcast. Remember to get a hold of us. Give us a call at 503-454-6941. Tell us what you think about J-Horror. You can also email us at feedback@creepercast.com. Leave a voice message at creepercast.com by clicking on the little pop-up on the left-hand side. You can become a fan and a follower on Twitter and Facebook by going to twitter.com/creepercast and facebook.com/creepercast. And, of course, we're on Google Plus by going to creepercast.com/G+. Mike, can you, or actually Jeff, can you tell us what we're talking about next week?
Next week, we actually have a cast member joining us, and we will be getting into Clive Barker's Book of Blood. That would be his films that he's written and directed. So we'll be touching on Hellraiser, Lord of Illusions, and Nightbreed with guest Kevin.
Mike, what are you talking about next week?
Well, to stick with the, you know, the whole Clive Barker thing, I did a lot of searching around trying to find some of the stuff at the library, but I ended up just going ahead and buying it for my Kindle. We're doing what actually started it all for a lot of us, at least literature guys. I'm doing The Hellbound Heart, which is obviously the basis for Hellraiser.
Yes, that sounds awesome. I love it, and I love Hellraiser, and this will actually be the second time me and Jeff have talked about Hellraiser, but I think the first time was, like, sometime in our first 10 episodes.
Yes, that's true, and I believe we're bringing an expert on Clive Barker when it comes down to it. He may prove me wrong, but I'm doubting it.
Right. See you guys next week.
Next week.
Next week.
Thank you for listening to my uncle's podcast.